Disc 9.
It would also be as well to discover if the scandal had leaked at all. On both counts, my best source would be the wife of my bosom, who may be tripe-brained, but has the eyes, ears, and instincts of an Afridi scout, especially for things that don't concern her. I made a leisurely patrol, quartering ground and sniffing the wind. The Lycett greens were nowhere to be seen, but Mrs. Wilson was fretting at her fan and listening absent-minded to Lady Coventry in the drawing-room. And when I looked in at the smoke-hole, young Wilson and Levitt were in deep confabulation, instantly dropped when I appeared, but not before I heard Levitt exclaim, "I can't touch it, Jack, I tell you. He's my chief, dash it." Signs and portents, thinks I, and passed on to the music-room, where one of the females was butchering yum-yum, to the feigned admiration of the company, and my quarry was ensconced in a corner, fleecing some unfortunate foreigner at backgammon, shaking the dice and her upper works, the abandoned old tart, in a way which plainly put him off his game altogether.
"Another double six, Count,"
trills she, all rosy triumph.
"I declare I never threw so many. Oh, and now a double four. What luck! Why, I am off entirely. Oh, dear, and you have a man on the bar still. Oh, what a shame! Harry, come and see. I have a backgammon. Aren't I lucky? No, no, Count, I won't have it. Put your purse in your pocket. We play for love, but not money,"
says she, looking roguish.
"No, no, I shan't take it, really, I assure you. Will you not play another game?"
"After two gammons and a backgammon in five games?" cries the ancient squarehead. "Ah, dear Lady Flashman, against chance and skill I can struggle, but when they are allied with beauty and charm, I am overpowered altogether. Am I not right, Sir Harry? But I insist on paying my just debts," says he, planting his sobs in her palm, which gave the old goat the chance to kiss her hand and take a last fond leer at her top hamper, while she purred and protested.
"Och, isn't he the wee duck?"
sighs she, jingling her lute as he hobbled away.
"Aye, weel, money a mickle makes a muckle, as Papa used to say."
She slipped it into her bag and broke into civilized speech.
"But you know, Harry, it was quite embarrassing, for I threw six and one, and double one, and double six, ever so often. I'm sure he believes I used loaded dice."
"Loaded tits, more like."
"I was so glad to see you, for he breathes ever so hard. I can't think why. And I could see he hated losing, and it was such a bore."
She lowered her voice as she took my arm.
"Indeed, it's all rather a bore, don't you think? Will we be able to go home tomorrow? Would the prince be offended? I feel I've had as much of Tranby company as I can bear. And I'm sure it can be no fun for you, dearest."
The piano gang had begun to perform the last rites on Three Little Maids with immense jollity, and as we went out she pulled her face and whispered,
"I mean the Wilsons do their best, and are ever so kind and, well, and eager to please. But they're not really quite the thing, are they?"
"She's God's own original snob, my little Paisley princess, as though her mill-owning father had been a whit better than the Wilsons. But the little skinflint had collared a peerage in his declining years, you see, and she seems to think that his coronet and cash, with my V.C. and military rank, to say nothing of her own occasional intimacy with the Queen, raised us above the common herd, which I guess they did, in an odd way, or if not above, apart at least. We ain't top draw, but there's no denying we're different. I told her if she'd had enough of it we could be away on the morning train. Now that the ledger's run, I doubt if H.R.H. will linger. But I thought you'd been enjoying yourself, old girl, what with cheering on the winners and sporting your glad rags. And most becoming you look, I may tell you, and being the life and soul and charming Dirty Bertie." Mention of her appearance had inevitably brought her to a halt at a mirror in the corridor, and now she gave me a reproachful blue eye in the reflection.
"I trust I know what is due to royal rank," says she primly, "and I may tell you that mere polite affability is not charming in the odious way you mean it."
She patted her gilded tresses complacently,
and touched a gloved finger to her plump pink cheek, sighing. "Anyway, I doubt my charming days are gone, lang syne."
"You don't think anything of the sort, neither does Billy Cumming, by all accounts. Oh, I've heard all about that. Flirting over the baccarat cards, the two of you."
Now, was there, or was there not, an instant flicker in those glorious eyes, before she widened them at me in mock indignation? "Flirting? Aye, upon my word." She tossed her head. "The very idea, at my time of life. Flirting, Cohi. Goodness me.
I had a touch of your time of life t'other night, remember?"
We were alone in the corridor, and I stepped close behind her and gave him a loving squeeze. She exclaimed, "Oh!" and hit me with her fan. "That was not flirting," says she. "I was a helpless victim, a poor defenceless old biddy, and you should think shame of yourself."
She gave her hair a last touch and turned to peck me on the cheek.
"And who says I tried to fetch Billy Cumming, I should like to know? No, stop it, you bad old man, and tell me."
"Owen Williams, an officer and a gent, so there. Very jolly over the cards together you were, he tells me."
"He's an old haver," says she elegantly, "just because a gentleman helps a lady to make her bets. Well, you know I can account."
"Except at backgammon, apparently."
"Backgammon or no, I'm a duffer at cards, as well you know, and I dare say I said something exceptionally foolish and made him laugh. As for flirting, Harry Flashman, who are you to talk? Do you not remember Mrs. Leo Lade and Kitty Stevens?"
"Names from 50 years ago, God help me, still green in her eccentric memory. And I didn't even know who Kitty Stevens was."
"Uh-huh, that's your eye on a plate, my lad," says she, slipping her arm through mine as we passed on. "What else did that Blether Williams tell you?"
"Now that was odd. Lightly asked, too lightly." "Oh, just that," says I. "I guess he was trying to take a rise out of me, knowing I can't stand Cumming, but not knowing that you can't stand him either." I gave her hand a squeeze, reassuring-like. "Why, you crossed him off our list years ago."
"Did I? I don't recollect."
"And that was odder still, for if there's an elephantine memory in London W1, it resides in the otherwise wayward mind of Elspeth Lady Flashman, as she had just proved by reference to Mrs. Leo Lade and that other bint, whoever she may have been. Suddenly I knew that something was up. For all her banter, she'd been on the QV from the moment Cumming's name was mentioned. The quick, wary glint in the mirror, her artless inquiry about what Williams had said, and the indifferent, "Did I don't recollect," told me she was keeping something from me. Was it possible that Cumming had been trying his lecherous hand again? At her age? Damned unlikely. Yet then again, Queen Ranna Valona had been a grandmother, and that hadn't stopped me. By God, if he had, I'd see to it that he came out of his present pickle with his name and fame in the gutter. But that could wait. I'd another fish to fry at the moment, and as we neared the drawing-room door, I paused, assuming a frown. Hold on, though. Yes, Williams did say another thing. Yes, at baccarat last night, did you notice anything, well, out of the way, about Cumming's play? She looked bewildered, but then, on any subject that hasn't to do with money or erotic activity, she usually is.
Why, Harry, whatever do you mean?
Was there anything remarkable about his placing of the stakes?
My stakes, do you mean? I told you he was helping me.
No, his stakes. How did he put them on the table? She looked at me as though I was simple-minded.
Why, with his hand, of course. He just put them down.
Yes, dearest, says I, keeping a firm grip on myself, but that's not quite what I mean.
Those wee coloured counters with the feathers on them, he just put them in front of him. And mine, too, because, you see, he was advising me how to bet, since I did not understand the rules, or how much it would be safe to wager. And I must say, says she, opening the floodgates, it is quite the silliest game, for there's no cleverness in it, and indeed I told him so. For how can we tell what to wager, I said, when we have no notion of what the prince's cards may amount to? Why, he may have a count of nine, and then where shall we be? He laughed and said we must take the risk, for it was a gamble. I know that, I said, but it would be more fun if we knew one of the prince's cards, and he knew one of ours, for then we could judge how much to put on. He said we must be like Montrose, and repeated that verse we used to recite at school. You know the one about fearing our fate too much, who will not put it to the touch to win nor lose it all. And I said, that is all very well, Sir William, but remember what happened to him. And he laughed more than ever.
I love her dearly, far beyond any creature I've ever known, and I can't prove it, for never once in almost 70 years of married life have I taken her by the throat. Mind you, it's been a near thing once or twice.
And the court cards, would you believe it, count for nothing? Why, then, I asked him, do they have them in the pack at all? And he said he supposed it was to make weight, whatever that may mean, and I said it was a great annoyance to have to pay out to the bank when we'd been dealt 2 kings, and got another when we asked for a 3rd card, and the prince's cards were the sorriest rags, but they made 8, and that was the better hand. But it seems hard that 3 kings should be worth nothing at all.
I took her gently by the arm, and steered her away from the drawing-room door to an alcove at the end of the corridor, for I could see there was only one way, and that was to come out with the thing plump and plain. Did you see coming, at any time, add counters to his stake after the prince had declared the result of the hand? She took her lower lip gently in her teeth, a tiny gesture of puzzlement, which has been turning my heart over since 1839.
You mean, after the prince had said who had won?
Precisely. She frowned.
But then, it would be too late to add to his stake, surely.
Well, that's the whole point, did he? At any time, after the result had been called, place any counters beyond the line.
Which line?
The line, I replied through gritted teeth, round the edge of the cloth on the table. It was like talking to a backward bushman. The line beyond which the stakes are placed.
Oh, is that what the line was for? I thought it was just for the look of the thing.
She reflected for a moment and shook her head.
No, I cannot think that I saw him putting up more counters after.
As realization dawned, the forget-me-not eyes opened wide and her lips parted.
Why, Harry, that would have been cheating.
Begad, you're right, so it would. But you never saw him do any such thing with his hands or a pencil.
Gracious, no. Why, I should have checked him at once and told him it would not do, that he'd made a mistake and must.
And at that she stopped short, staring at me, and slowly her alarm changed into the oddest old-fashioned look, and then she smiled, that old teasing, cherry-lipped Elspeth pout that used to have me thrust in the door too and wrenching at me breeches. To my astonishment I saw that her eyes were suddenly moist as she shook her head and came close to me, putting a gloved hand up to me whiskers.
"Oh, Harry, me Joe, you sweet old thing,"
murmured she.
"Is that why you're tasking me with all these daft questions? Because that clavering old clipe Owen Williams has told you that Billy Cumming put his hand on mine once or twice at the baccarat?"
She laughed softly, loving sad, and stroked my withered cheek.
"To be sure he did, but only to guide me in placing my wager, silly. And you're still jealous for your old wife, wild lad that you are. Well, I'm glad, so there. Come here."
And she kissed me, in a way which any decent matron should have forgotten long ago.
"As though I've ever wanted to fetch any man but you,"
says she fondly, straightening my collar.
"Supposing I still could. No, if you give me your arm to the drawing-room, I dare say Mrs. Wilson will be serving tea."
The deuce of it is, when Elspeth turns a conversation topsy-turvy, all wide-eyed innocence, you can never be sure whether it's witlessness or guile. She's always been ivory from her delightful neck upwards, but that don't mean she can't wheedle a duck from a pond when so minded. Knowing her vanity, supposing I still could, my eye, I didn't doubt that she believed my inquiries had been prompted by pure jealousy, to her immense gratification, lovingly expressed. Still, there was something to do with coming that she wasn't telling. Well, perhaps it was something I'd be better for not knowing. One thing seemed clear, for what it was worth, whoever had seen him cheating, she had not. I left her prattling over the cups to Lady Coventry, and on the spur of the moment decided not to visit the prince to see how his fine frenzy was coming along, but to call on the principal in the case, as promising more information and entertainment. Faced with ruin and dishonour, coming should be an interesting spectacle by now, and a little manly condolence from old comrade Flashy might well lead him to do something amusing. The more mischief, the better sport, as the great man said. He was taking it well, I'll say that, standing before his mantle, every inch the gardee, rock steady, and looking down his aristocratic nose. I guessed he was a volcano ready to erupt, though, and when he dismissed his valet, I took him flat aback by holding out my hand, avoiding his grip, and seeking his pulse. I do love to startle him. "What the deuce?" cries he, pulling free. "A touch fast, not much. You'll do." In fact, I hadn't found his pulse. "Seen the prince, have you?" "So you've heard." "Yes, I have seen his highness." He eyed me with profound dislike. "I suppose you too believe this filthy slander." "Why should you think that?" says I, taking a chair. "Those other idiots do, Williams and Coventry, and the prince. And when did you ever believe good of anyone?" "Not often, perhaps, but then they don't often deserve it. In your case, as it happens, I'm probably the only man in this house who is not convinced that you played foul." His sneer vanished in astonishment, and he took a pace forward, only to stop in sudden doubt. "You're not? Why?" "Leery of me, you see. Many people are." "Because it makes no sense." I told him my reasons, which you know, and with every word his expression lightened, until he was looking almost hopeful in a frantic way. "Have you said this to the prince? What did he say, in heaven's name?" I shook my head. "Didn't persuade him, or Coventry and Williams. Can't blame him altogether, you know. The evidence is pretty strong on the face of it. 5 witnesses." "Witnesses?" cries he. "Damned imbeciles. 2 idiot women. A parcel of boys who know nothing. What's their word worth?" Almost in an instant the cool guardee was gone, and he was standing before me, fists clenched and eyes wild, voice shaking with fury. Strange how a man can show a calm front and a stiff lip when all the world's agin him, but drop a sympathetic word, and all the rage and indignation will come bubbling out, because he thinks he's found a friend to confide in. "How can they believe it?" he stormed. "My God, Flashman, how can they? Men who've known me 20 years and more, trusted friends, as though I would stoop to this damned infamy. And for what?" There were tears in his eyes, and if he'd stamped and torn his hair, I'd not have been surprised. "For a few paltry pounds? By heaven, I'll throw it back in their faces." "Not if you've any sense, you won't," says I, and he stared. "Might be taken for an admission of guilt. You won it, fair and square, did you? Then you keep it." Sound advice, by the way. "That's the whole point, though," I added, sitting forward and giving him my eye. "Now come in, don't start tearing the curtains, but tell me, straight out, did you cheat?" He was breathing hard, but at that he stiffened and answered straight. "I did not, on my word of honour." He was telling the truth, no question. Not because he said so, but because of what I'd seen and heard from the moment I'd entered the room. I don't claim to be an infallible judge of my fellow man and woman. I can be deceived, and put no faith in oaths and promises, however solemn. But I've been about, and if I knew anything at all, Gordon Cummings' demeanour, in and out of anger, rang true. "Very good. Now, these witnesses, are they lying?" That sent him away again. "How the blazes should I know? The whole thing is abominable. What's it to me whether they're lying or not? Pack of idiots and prying women. Who cares what they say? Let me tell you, Flashman, their foul charges don't matter a straw to me. They're worthless. But that men like Williams and the Prince, whom I counted a friend, that they should turn against me, that they can bring themselves to believe this vile thing. My God! And that you, of all people, should be alone in having faith in me." I dare say he didn't mean it to sound like an insult, but it did, and I found myself liking him even less than usual. He had gulped himself silent with outrage, so I resumed. "You haven't answered. Are they lying?"
"I neither know nor care."
He paced about and stopped, glaring at the wall. Oh, I suppose not. The damned fools must think they saw something wrong. But who knows with ignorant young asses like those? What do they know of card play, even, or how such games are conducted? Tyros and schoolboys. That dummy Levitt. That he should think for a moment, stop vaporing and keep your head. I told him. Damn it, man, I'm trying to help you. I wasn't, but there. If you want to come out of this, you'd best stop ranting and think. Now then, they weren't lying, you believe. So, they were mistaken. How? That's the thing. What was there in your play, the way you staked, that made him think you were diddling them? I offered him a cheroot and struck a match. Now, settle down and think that over. He puffed at the weed in silence, made to speak, thought better of it, and then shrugged helplessly. How can I tell what they think they saw? Minds like theirs, stupid women, and scatterbrains like young Wilson? Well, that won't answer. See here, from what I've learned, they claim that on two or three occasions you had a £5 stake in front of you, and then, hey presto, it was £15 after the hand had been declared. Now, how could that be? Think, man, unless they were seeing things, you must have added another two red chips to the one already there. Did you? Could you? No, don't start bellowing. Think. If you weren't cheating, how came those extra chips to be there? He stood, nursing his brow, and turned to me a face that was haggard with frustration. I don't know, Flashman. It can't have been so. I swear I never added to my stake after the... And suddenly he stopped, and his eyes and mouth opened wide, and he gave a choking gasp. Oh, my God! Of course! The coup de toi! That's it, Flashman. The coup de toi! And he let out a great wailing noise, which I took to be relief. The coup de toi! What the hell's the coup de toi? My system! His eyes were blazing. Why didn't I think of it at once? I was tripling up, don't you see? Looking up. He lugged a handful of coins from his pocket, spilling them all over the shop, and planked one on the table. There, that's my £5 stake. I win, and have paid a fiver from the bank. He clapped down a second coin. I let him lie, and add another fiver. Down went a third coin. And that's my stake for the next hand, £15. It's how I always play. Stake a fiver, win another, add a third. The coup de toit. He was laughing in sheer triumph. Why, it's as old as the hills. Every punter knows it. But not those green monkeys, Wilson and Levitt. They see a fiver staked, look away, look back again after the coup's been declared, and the bank has paid out, and see three fivers. My original stake, my winning, and the third, which I've added for the next coup, perfectly properly. He let out a huge gasp of relief and subsided into a chair. And because they're ignorant novices brought up on Old Maid and Halmer, they think it's foul play. The only thing is, says I, that they're sure you added the extra chips after the coup was declared, but before the bank paid out, and that you accepted payment of £15. Then they're wrong, that's all. It's a question of timing, can't you see? They say that on one coup you jockeyed your stake and demanded an extra tenner from the bank. Stuff and nonsense, and that once you flicked a chip over the line with a pencil. That is a lie. He was on his feet again, white with anger. Damn it, man, can't you see sense? Don't you see what has happened? Some young fool sees my coup de toit, thinks it's a fraud, tells the other young fools, and because they're as dense as he is, aye, and as eager to believe the worst. They see all manner of things that ain't there. Flicking chips with pencils, bah! In his excitement, he took me by the arm. Don't you see, Flashman? In fact, I did, and was feeling much let down, for what he said made some sort of sense, perhaps. Half-baked lads like Levitt and Wilson, knowing nothing of such systems as the coup de toit, employed by seasoned gamesters like Cumming, might well misinterpret his actions. It was, as he said, a question of timing, and in an ill-regulated drawing-room game, with no croupier on the first night, and the bank paying out any old how, it was possible that they might have thought Cumming was still to be paid, when in fact he'd already got his winnings and was letting him lie, with an additional fiver for the next coup. Now, if the thing were explained to them, they'd surely be bound to give him the benefit of the doubt, for Bertie would leap at the explanation as a lifeline, and for decency's sake, they'd have to admit that they might have been mistaken. If there'd been a cat handy, I'd have kicked it. What had promised to be a splendid scandal looked like fizzling out, like the dampest of squibs. And this damned baronet would walk away without a blot on his escutcheon. Or so it seemed to me just then. From the first, you see, I'd feared that there might be a simple explanation, and here was a plausible one. Rot it. It was almost damnably deflating, and worse, 'cause I'd guided him to his bloody loophole of escape. "Don't you see?" cries he again, impatiently. "Heavens, it's as plain as daylight now. You must see that. It's obvious to anyone above a half-wit. Even a mutton-head like Williams can't fail to see it. Am I right?" I put on my judicial face and said that he probably was. "Well, thank God for that," cries he sarcastically. And if anything had been needed to convince me he was telling the truth, it was his sneering tone. Not a hint of doubt that his explanation mightn't wash. No palpitating hope of its acceptance. Only cold fury that he, the soul of honour, had been disgracefully traduced, and that his peers had believed it. 2 minutes since he'd been in an agony of despair, but now Sir William Gordon coming, but was back in the saddle, bursting with injured self-righteousness and the arrogant certainty of his kind, and, you'll note, not a whisper of gratitude to your correspondent. "The prince must be told at once. He's a man of sense. Unlike those clowns, Coventry and Williams, I don't doubt they persuaded him against his will, but when I put it to him, he'll see the right of it." He was at his dressing-table, flourishing his silver-backed brushes, improving his parting, with a dab or two at the ends of his pathetic gardee moustache, and shooting his cuffs, while I marvelled at the human capacity for self-delusion. He was full of exultant confidence now, and it never crossed his shallow mind that others might be less ready to take his view of the matter. I've said his explanation was plausible, but it wasn't near as cast iron as he thought. Much would depend on how it was presented, and how ready they were to believe it.
"It may be a lesson to them against jumping to conclusions, and on such flimsy evidence, the babbling of those whippersnappers. And my character, my good name, my record of honourable service, were to count for nothing against their damned gossip, the confounded little spies."
He was striding for the door in full raging fettle, when he suddenly wheeled about.
"No, by heavens, I'll not do it."
He snapped his fingers, pointing at me.
"Why should I?"
"Why shouldn't you do what?" was all I could say, for his anger had dropped from him like a shed cloak, and he was smiling grimly as he came slowly back to me.
"Why should I humble myself with explanations? I'm the injured party, am I not? I'm the one who has suffered this intolerable affront. I've been insulted in the grossest fashion on the word of a pack of mannerless brats, and two elderly fools who, I have no doubt, persuaded his Royal Highness against his better judgment and honourable instincts."
Drunk with vindictive justification he might be, he wasn't ass enough to impugn saintly Bertie. He gave a barking laugh.
"Lord Flashman, in our father's day I'd have been justified in blowing their imbecile heads off on Calais sands. Am I to crawl to them and say, 'Please, sir, I can prove your informants?' Informers, I should say, have been utterly in the wrong, and will you kindly tell him so, and condescend to forgive me for having conducted myself like a man of honour? Is that what I'm supposed to do?"
Talk about women scorned. Their fury ain't in it with a Scotch baronet's wounded self-esteem. Had I ever, I wondered, encountered such an immortally conceited ass with a truer touch for self-destruction? George Custer came to mind. I put him and Gordon coming on the edge of a precipice, and I'd not care to bet which would tumble first into the void, bellowing his grievance. "What," says I, keeping my countenance with proper gravity, "do you propose to do?"
"Not a damn thing. You," stabbing me on the chest, "since you've thrust your spoon into the Dixie, can do it for me. You can be my messenger, Flashman, and have the satisfaction of showing them what asses they've made of themselves. You've got the gift of the gab, don't we know it?"
says he with a curl of his voice, if not of his lip. "You can explain about the coup de toit and the rest of it, 'cause I'm damned if I will. It's not for me to make a plea to them. Let them come to me. I'll accept their apology, Coventry and Williams, I mean, and those three gutter snipes. Well, not the ladies, of course, and certainly not His Royal Highness, who has been most disgracefully imposed on, I'm sure of that." "Yes," says he, head up and shoulders square, with exultation in his eye. "That's the way to do it. So off you go, old fellow, and don't spare 'em." Seeing me, Stan thoughtfully frowned impatiently. "Well, will you?" "Would I not? I've told you my score against Gordon Cumming, a natural detestation of his supercilious vanity, his unconcealed dislike of me, above all the suspicion that he'd ploughed with my heifer, and now, if you please, the arrogant bastard was appointing me his message boy. Throw into the scale his overweening certainty that he'd cleared himself, and must be grovelled to in consequence, and you'll understand, if you know me at all, that I would not have missed the chance to sink the swine, not for my soul's salvation. For it was in my hands, no error, his coup de trois excuse had put the whole affair on a knife edge. If it were shrewdly urged, the three wise men and the witnesses might be disposed, for the sake of avoiding a horrid scandal, to swallow it. Well, by the time I'd done with it, they'd spew it all over the floor. So I consented to act as his go-between, and left him grinding his teeth at the prospect of accusers confounded and honour restored. No time, we agreed, must be lost, so I made for the prince's apartments. And whom should I meet on the way but the three leading witnesses, plainly just come from a royal audience? Master Wilson, bright with excitement, Lycett Green, tight-lipped, and young Levitt, plainly wishing himself in the Outer Hebrides. No change on that front, thinks I, and the air of gloom in HRH's sitting-room, most of it cigar smoke, confirm my conclusion. "That fellow is impossible," Bertie was croaking, and I gather he meant Lycett Green. "Not a shadow of doubt, according to him. It's intolerable. What can we do but believe them?" "As your Highness says," Coventry sounded like a vicar at the graveside. "That being so, we're bound to take—" He frowned as he dredged his vocabulary. "Ah, measures in regard to Sir William."
"Lycett Green won't keep quiet if we don't," says Williams.
"Self-righteous ass," snaps Bertie. "No, that's not fair. He's a decent man, no doubt. I only wish he weren't so infernally adamant." He scowled at me. "Well?" I said I'd seen Gordon come in. "How much good that will have done. I've seen him myself. It was heartbreaking, I tell you. The man almost had tears in his eyes. One of my closest friends. I'd have trusted him with my life. But how can I credit his denial in the face of—" He flourished a paw in the direction of the door. "They're so sure. Even Levitt, poor devil. Heavens, we can hardly drag it out of him." He sat down, groaning, drew on his cigar as though it were poisoned, and regarded me dyspeptically. "What did Cumming have to say to you?" "Denied it absolutely. I suppose he gave your Highness his explanation." That brought him bolt upright. "What explanation?" I hesitated with an artistic frown and shook my head. "I don't quite know what to make of it myself. I confess that I... At that I stopped, waiting for him to demand what the devil I was talking about, which he did with considerable vigour. "Well, sir," I began, half apologetic, and then I gave him the coup de trois story, plain and matter-of-fact, but with dark doubt hovering over every word, and was gratified to see Coventry's face growing long as a coffin, Williams frowning in disbelief, and the light of hope fading from Bertie's bloodshot ogles. "Do you believe it?" cries he, and I maintained the manly silence that damned Gordon Cumming as no words could. "But is it possible?" he insisted. "Possible, sir." I made a lip and shrugged. I dare say it's possible."
"But even if it were true," broke in Williams, "and you plainly don't think it is, it still does not explain all the irregularities, the pencil, that sort of thing."
He met Bertie's despairing eye.
"I regret to say it, sir, but it sounds to me like the feeble excuse of a desperate man. And I'm sure," he added, "that that is how Green and the others will regard it."
Coventry heaved a draughty sigh. "Indeed, it only confirms my belief that Sir William, that the witnesses, the charges—"
"That he's a cheat and a liar,"
cries Bertie. He growled down his temper, gnashed on his cigar, and faced us.
"Very well, then. God knows we've done our best to sift the thing, and that's our conclusion. He's played foul and been caught out. Now," says he. And for the first time that night he sounded royal.
How is it to be hushed up? They stood mum, so I put in my oar again. Afraid it can't be, sir, unless you and Williams are prepared to risk a court-martial. If I'd said, are prepared to steal the crown jewels and make a run for Paraguay, I couldn't have provoked a finer display of consternation. But before Bertie could explode, I explained. You and he both hold the Queen's commission, sir. I'm retired, of course, but as serving officers, aware of dishonourable conduct by a brother officer, you're obliged to bring it to the attention of your superiors. Since your highness is a field marshal, I'm not sure who your superiors are, exactly. Her majesty, of course. Or, I dare say, the colonel of Cummings' regiment would do. I was drowned out by a prolonged fit of princely coughing, the result of outraged smoke going down the wrong way, which gave him time to digest my warning and emerge, mopping and wheezing, to announce hoarsely that he didn't give a tinker's damn for courts-martial, or words to that effect. And not a whisper was to be breathed to military superiors or anyone else. Was that clear? It must not come out, he croaks. At all costs, it must be confined to ourselves. The scandal. He couldn't bring himself even to contemplate it. A way must be found. He sat down again, thumping his knees. It must. Which left us back at the starting gate, three of us racking our brains, and Flashy looking perplexed, but inwardly serene, for all I was waiting for was a lead. At last Coventry gave it. If some accommodation could be found, says he, which would signify a disapprobation of Sir William's conduct while satisfying the resentment of his accusers, and, of course, ensuring that no word of this deplorable affair ever... Oh, talk sense, Coventry, barks Bertie. They want his head on a charger. Green made that plain enough, and how you're to contrive that in secrecy I cannot imagine. How do you punish him without exposing him? Wonders Williams. And I saw it was time for the Flashman compromise, which had been taking shape in my mind over the past minute or two. I made a judicial noise to attract their attention. I wonder if Lord Coventry hasn't pointed the way, sir, says I. Suppose, yes, how would it do if Cumming were to sign a paper, you know, an undertaking sort of thing, pledging himself never to touch a card again, eh? They stood mute as ducks in thunder. Stiff penalty for a man in his position, what? I'd be surprised if that didn't satisfy Green and his pals. And in return, I tapped the table impressively. They would pledge themselves to silence, as would we, absolutely. That would settle things without a breath of scandal. There was a hole in it a mile wide, but I knew Bertie wouldn't spot it. My last five words were all that mattered to him. He was pointing like a setter. Coventry was in his customary fog. But Williams burst out. Cumming would never do such a thing. Why, it would be tantamount to a confession of guilt. Not a bit of it, Owen, says I. He ain't admitting a thing, and if he were, it would only be to us, and his accusers, who think he's guilty anyway. No one else would ever know. I turned to Bertie, his cigar now in tatters. I'm sure he'll agree, sir. What other choice has he? Public disgrace, and worse than that. I went on, fixing Coventry and Williams with my sternest look. Would be the shameful burden of knowing that greater names than his had been tarnished by the publication of his dishonour. That did the trick. Bertie started as though I'd put a bayonet into his leg, and from Williams's expression I knew that if I'd said, tell Cumming that if he don't do as he's told and preserve our precious prince from scandal, God help him, I could not have been plainer. Coventry naturally was appalled. But such a document... Supposing Sir William should consent to sign it in return for a pledge of silence, would it not bear an odour of conspiracy? Certainly not, says I. It would be a simple promise never to play cards again, signed by him, duly witnessed by His Royal Highness, and by the accusers. Nothing smoky about it. They'd give their word of honour to His Highness never to speak or write of the matter hereafter, and that would be that, tight as a drum. Bertie hadn't said a word for several minutes, and when he did, it was clear what was preoccupying him. Could we be sure those people would keep silence? Once they'd given their word to the Prince of Wales, says I, and that seemed to satisfy him, for he sat in silence a moment, and then asked the other two what they thought of the scheme. They puffed doubtfully, of course, Williams, because he feared that Cumming would refuse to sign, and Coventry out of general anxiety. Would Lycett, Green and Company agree, he wondered, and Bertie let out a muffled snarl. They'll agree, says he grimly, which settled that, and they passed on to the wording of the document, which was simple enough, and then to considering how it might best be put to the guilty party. Bertie wondered if I should take part with Coventry and Williams, but modesty forbade. "I'm no diplomat, sir," says I. "Too blunt by half. His lordship and own will do it 10 times better without me. Besides," I added, "blunt, honest, old flashy. The fact is he don't like me. Don't know why, but there is no point in putting his back up. So the less I mention, the better." Do you know, Williams absolutely shook his head in sympathy, and Bertie went so far as to give my arm a clap before I withdrew. He was even more demonstrative an hour later when I was summoned to his presence just as I was on the point of turning in, and found him sitting on the edge of his bed, in his dressing-gown, a glass in hand, cigar at the high port, plainly dog-weary but content at having laboured well in the vineyard. "Well, he's signed," cries he jovially. He picked up a paper and held it out, just a few lines with a forest of names at the foot, led by W. Gordon Cumming and the Prince's scrawl. "Not without the juice of a struggle, Owen Williams tells me. Swore it was tantamount to confession, but gave in when they told him it was that or ruin. Help yourself, Flashman," indicating decanter and humidor. "And sit you down. Gad, I don't care if I never have such an evening again. After dinner, too, shan't sleep a wink." He swigged comfortably. "Do you know, I did not half believe he'd put his signature to it. But you knew, downy old bird that you are." He was positively twinkling. "Well, sir, he really didn't have much choice, did he? All things considered, he's come off damn lightly. That's what Lycett Green thinks, though he'd the grace not to say so. Oh, aye, they've all put their names to it, as you see." He peered at the paper, shaking his head. "I must say it's a damning thing for an innocent man to sign. And yet," he screwed up his little eyes at me, "do you think there's the least possibility he's telling the truth?" "Look at it this way, sir. Would you have signed it, knowing yourself innocent? Or would you have damned them for liars and offered to put them through every court in the land? Or taken a horsewhip to them?" "And think what Mama would have made of that," I might have added. He looked solemn, wagging his head, and then demanded, almost peevishly, "What the devil possessed him to do it? To cheat, I mean. Was he off his head, do you think? You know, temporarily deranged? One hears of such things." "Dunno, sir, and I doubt if he does, either." He shook his head and rumbled a few philosophies while we sipped and smoked. He was enjoying his relief, and when we parted, he was at his most affable, pumping my fin and calling me Harry again. "I'm obliged to, not for the first time. This," he tapped Cumming's paper, "was a brainwave, and the sooner it's safely bestowed, the better. Not the sort of item we'd care to see in the morning press. What? Well, good night to you, old fellow. Thank you again. Aye, and thank the Lord we'll hear no more of it." "And if you believe that, sweet prince, you will indeed believe anything," thinks I. For if there was one stone-cold certainty, it was that we would hear more, abundantly more, and running over, of the great baccarat scandal of Tranby Croft. Bertie, blind to everything but the need to keep it from the Queen's ears, and asses like Coventry and Williams, might suppose that the vows of silence sworn by all and sundry would prove binding, honour, and all that, you know. I knew better. At least a dozen folk, two of them women, were in the secret, and the notion that they'd all hold their tongues was plain foolish. It was bound to get out, as I'd determined it should from the moment I'd stood in Gordon Cumming's presence, weighed him up, and realized what a prime subject he was for shoving down the drain. All it needed after that, as you know, was an inspiration and careful management. Now nature could take its course, which it did, and if it took longer to leak out than I'd expected, the resultant row was worth the delay. It's still not established who blew the gaff, but my firm belief is that it was Bertie himself, unlikely as that may seem. But the fact is that the Yankee papers named as their source none other than Elspeth's chum, Daisy Brook, aforementioned. It was they who christened her Babbling Brook. And since she was warming the princely mattress in those days, it's odds on that he whispered the scandal to her. More fool he. Daisy swore twasn't so and threatened to sue, but never did. Whoever blabbed, it was all over the clubs and messes before Christmas, that Cumming had cheated, chaps were cutting him dead, and he was demanding retractions and apologies and not getting them. So, there he was, reputation blasted, and nothing for it, you'd have thought, but to order a pint of port and a pistol for breakfast, or join the Foreign Legion. He did neither. To the shocked murmurs and secret glee of society, the delight of the public, and I've no doubt the terror of the Prince of Wales, he brought an action for slander against his five accusers from Tranby. The trial came off in June of 91, and it's one of the regrets of my life that I was not present, if only to see stout Bertie in the witness box, squirming under the inquisition of saucy jurors who didn't know their place, unlike the judge and counsel who grovelled to him something servile, and did everything but tote him in and out of court in a palanquin. The proceedings lasted a week, and by all accounts it was one of the finest legal circuses ever seen, with the judge as ringmaster, and nothing lacking but an orchestra and chorus girls. Knowing our revered Lord Chief Justice of the day, the ancient Coleridge, I was surprised, for he was a jolly old buck with a tremendous fund of good stories. Once made a speech, lasting 23 days, they tell me, and was responsible for the 3-mile limit, in case you're interested. You may be sure I was sorely tempted once or twice to view the spectacle, but decided reluctantly to keep clear. When you've had a hand in engineering a disaster, it's best to stand well out from under to avoid falling debris. I knew Bertie and Co. wouldn't advertise my part in the affair, which was deplorable enough without the notorious Flashy being dragged in. And sure enough, they didn't. One or two knew I'd been at Tranby quizzed me, but I took a stern and silent line. You know, shocking business, old comrade. Beyond belief, state of the army, damnable altogether, that sort of thing. Aside from the verdict, which I'll tell you presently in case you don't know, the great sensation was the storm that burst over the head of our unfortunate heir apparent. God forbid I should ever feel sorry for the fat bounder, but even I was astonished at the way the press and pulpits laid into him. You'd have thought he'd been kidnapping nuns and selling to the port side brothels, and all because he'd been playing baccarat. Woe to the monarchy, wailed one rag. Another spoke of a chorus of condemnation, and the rest expressed shock and disgust, denounced his taste for the lowest type of gambling, and recoiled from the spectacle of the future King of England officiating at a gambler's orgy. Even the Times went wild, with terms like regret, concern, and distress. A Scotch journal decided that the prince is evidently not what he ought to be. But the leader I liked best was the one that said the British Empire was humiliated, and the rest of civilization was pointing the finger at us. As to the trial itself, you can go to the official record if you've a mind to, but I flatter myself you won't learn much that I haven't told you. The lawyers went back and forth over every blessed moment of those 3 nights, every shift of those damned counters, every syllable of who said what to whom, and what expressions they wore, and what they thought and why, over and over. And I dare say at the end of it the jury were as fogged as the public. The biggest guns of the day fought the case. Clark, the Solicitor General, no less, who appeared for Cumming, was reckoned the shrewdest mouthpiece of the day, while the defendants were represented by 2 of the best hatchet men in the business, Charles Russell and young Asquith. You know the latter as the buffoon who infests number 10 Downing Street at the moment. And my recollection of him is as a shining morning face, to which I once presented a prize at the City of London School. But for all that, he was accounted a sharp hand in court, while Russell was a human hawk and looked it. Reading the press reports, I concluded that the evidence given didn't differ much from what I myself remembered of events, and in nothing essential. Owen Williams had drawn up a précis of what had happened at Tranby, in which various holes were picked. There seemed to be uncertainty over the order of the interviews on the Wednesday evening, and some vagueness as to who had suggested presenting the damning document to Cumming. which wasn't surprising since it had been yours truly, and they were keeping me out of it. Elspeth likewise. I'd been worried that she might be called as a witness, since on the first night she'd sat on as an onlooker, and on the second had for a time taken Lady Coventry's place next to Cummin. But either they'd forgotten about her, or more likely they'd remembered, and had realized that the last thing the trial needed was her drivelling brightly in the witness box. Like several others of the party, she wasn't even mentioned, none of which mattered to the case. Cummin, in evidence, repeated his flat denial of the charges, claiming that he'd lost his head and signed the paper only because he'd been persuaded that there was no other way to avoid a public scandal. He got in a sly thrust at Bertie by suggesting that His Royal Highness had been chiefly concerned to cover his own ample rear, which, as I knew, was gospel true. The five accusers stuck by their stories pretty well, although Clark, who was obviously a complete hand at confusing the issue with trivial questions, claimed to find all kinds of discrepancies in their testimony. He also hinted, ever so delicately, that a couple of them might have been tight, had great fun about Lysette Green's being a master of foxhounds, and took a nice injured line of surprise that in view of Cummings' pledged word, stainless character and so forth, they weren't prepared to admit they'd been mistaken. His final speech was four times as long as that of Russell, who simply went straight at Cummings' throat. Why hadn't he demanded to be brought face to face with his accusers, as any honest man would have done? He also reminded the jury that the five accusers weren't alone in thinking Cummin guilty. The Prince, Williams, and Coventry thought so too. In all that I read, I could put my finger on only one flat lie, the defendant's denial that there had been any arrangement to keep watch on Cummings' play the second night. Well, I ask you, you're told a man has been cheating, and don't keep an eye on him next time. Pull the other one, Walker. You watch him like a lynx. According to Owen Williams, they'd told him they'd agreed to watch, but now, in the witness box, they were claiming they'd done no such thing. Their reason was plain enough. They didn't want to be thought of as spying on a fellow guest. And there was some fine wriggling under cross-examination. One of them, I think it was Lysette Green, absolutely said, "Knowing the man had cheated, I looked, but not with a view to watching." Which is as fine a piece of humbug as I could have thought up myself. Not that it made a ha'porth of difference. They'd seen what they'd seen and held by it. By the morning of the seventh day, with the cases of both sides completed, the thing was on a knife edge. Half the town was positive Gordon Cummin was the biggest cheat since Jacob, while t'other half held that Clark had shown up the five accusers for unreliable idiots, if not vindictive parvenus, whose evidence wasn't worth stale beans. Perambulating from the park to the temple during the day, I heard Cummin damned and defended in the clubs. But the farther east I walked, the more I encountered a truly British phenomenon. Among the commonalty, the anti-Cummings wanted to see him done down for precisely the same reason that the pro-Cummings hoped he'd win, cause he was a toff. The Lord-haters were full of righteous indignation about the pampered rich, rioting and gaming, while honest folk went hungry. So to hell with Cummin and the Prince of Wales and the lot of them. On the other side were the Forelock Tuggers, who thought it a bleeding disgrace that a proper gent what had fought for the Queen and country should be defamed by the likes of them nobodies. No wonder the foreigners can't understand us. No doubt because I hope to see him sunk to perdition. I could imagine several excellent reasons why the jury should find in his favour and award him thumping damages. Foremost in my mind still, you see, was the conviction that he couldn't have cheated. Spite and prejudice aside, it wasn't in the man's nature. But it was up to the jury now, and no doubt all hung on the direction they would receive from the venerable Coleridge. The early editions were carrying his summing up at length, and I studied it eagerly in the corner of a Fleet Street pub, with a pie and pint to keep me company. The day's proceedings had begun with a protest from that ass Owen Williams, demanded to make a statement against the Solicitor General, Clark, who, says Williams, had accused him of an abominable crime of sacrificing an innocent man. Coleridge couldn't remember what exact words had been used, but told Williams that counsel could say what they damn well liked in court, and would Williams kindly keep quiet and give him, Coleridge, some judging room or words to that effect. After which Williams presumably retired, gnashing, and Coleridge addressed the 12 good men and true. It must have been a sight to see, for he apparently played the wise, simple old codger, peering over his glasses while he told the jury what brilliant chaps Clark and Russell and Asquith were. He didn't say they were too clever by half exactly, but he thought it no bad thing that the humble jog-trot of his summing up should intervene between their fireworks and the verdict. Having put the wigged brigade in their place, he told the jury something that was news to me, that cheating at cards was an offence for which you could be nailed in court. He then went on to remind them that Clark had said Cumming wasn't interested in soaking his accusers. They would bear that in mind if the question of damages arose. 100 to 80 he'll tell them to fine for Cumming, thinks I. And another thing, whether they disapproved of gambling or not was beside the point, which was simply this, did Cumming cheat or not? He rambled on, fairly reasonably it seemed to me, about the actual play and the witness's testimony, and caused some mirth by describing Cumming's system of betting as sounding like coup d'etat. Well, he knew it couldn't be coup d'etat, but it was some French expression or other. Oh, coup de trois, was it? Ah, well. On he went, honest old Coleridge, as gentle and benign as could be, drawing the jury's attention to various points, reminding them that it didn't matter a hoot what he thought, it was up to them, and all he could do was raise questions for them, which they must answer. Only once did he rouse himself to have a brief bicker with Clark for seeming to turn up his nose at the social standing of some of the accusers. It wasn't Lysette Green's fault that his father was an engineer, was it? And if young Jack Wilson was a shiftless layabout, what was wrong with that? And if the Wilsons toadette the prince, why, who did not? Clark said he hadn't called Lysette Green's father an engineer. Coleridge said, well, if he hadn't, his junior had. No, he hadn't either, says Clark. But Coleridge ignored him and said he didn't see why a chap should be laughed at because his father was an engineer, and if a chap liked hobnobbing with the prince, where was the harm? Eh, it wouldn't prejudice him against Gordon Cumming anyway. And that was the point. Furthermore, this stuff about Gordon Cumming losing his head didn't impress the bench. Cumming had had lots of time to think before he signed the paper and knew what he was doing. He hadn't asked to be confronted by his accusers either. Pretty rum, that seemed to Coleridge. And he hadn't returned his winnings. Put him in the bank. 238 quid's worth. Well, well. Having read this far, I felt the odds were shifting in the direction of the defendants, but you still couldn't tell. Then the silly old buffer got on to a new tack, the Prince of Wales. Well, Coleridge couldn't see the throne toppling simply because the prince had played baccarat. The prince had a busy public life, opening things and making speeches and listening to speeches, and a hell of a bore it must be, in Coleridge's view. So if he wanted to enjoy himself an evening, why not? Some people might say, why not read the Bible instead of playing baccarat? But it was a free country, wasn't it? Sound stuff, in its way, interspersed with quotations from Shakespeare, including a bit of Henry V at Agincourt on the subject of honour, and other authors with whom he didn't doubt the jury were familiar, and a few Latin tags to remind them that this was serious work. And then at the end of his summing up, when they must have been sitting in a restful fog, he left off playing the genial philosophizing old buffer, and delivered the thrust that settled the case once and for all. Would an innocent man, he wondered, sign a document stating he had cheated simply to prevent its being known that the Prince of Wales had played baccarat? Would a man allow himself to be called a card sharp, rather than have it known that the prince had done something of which many people might disapprove? No, Coleridge couldn't swallow that. The jury retired, and that, blast it, was as far as the report went, so I set off for home, and it was in the gentle even fall that I came on a newsboy hollering, "Verdict!" at the corner of Bruton Street. And there it was in the stock press. The jury had taken only 13 minutes to find for the defendants. So, that was Cumming ruined. The 12 good men had declared him a cheat and a liar. I confess it took me aback. Splendid news, though it was. How the devil had a jury of Englishmen, brought up to give a man the benefit of the doubt, come to that conclusion? Still, they'd been in court and I'd not, and they'd reached their decision double quick, hadn't they just, in hardly more time than it would take to call for votes round the table? No doubts, apparently, and certainly no arguments. Strangely, where opinion had been evenly divided before, it swung violently to Cumming after the verdict. One learned journal opined that you wouldn't have hung a dog on the evidence that he'd cheated, and I heard it said on every side that the thing should never have come to trial at all. It should have been settled at Tramby, and would have been, but for ill-advised zeal on the part of the prince's friends, to save him from scandal. The irony was that in spite of all the reverential treatment and may it please your royal highness in he'd received in court, the trial did Bertie more damage than any other incident in his well-spotted career. The press, as I've said, damned him from Belgrade to breakfast, and when he issued a statement, with the blessing, they say, of the Prime Minister and the Archbishop of Canterbury, protesting that he had a horror of gambling and did his utmost to discourage it, he was seen for the windy little hypocrite he was, and hooted in the streets. Cumming was finished socially and professionally, of course, and had the sense to resign, marry his American girl, and retire to Scotland. If I knew him at all, any shame he felt would be nothing to his rage against the society that had branded him, and the prince who'd betrayed him, and I dare say he's brooding in his Highland fastness this minute, armoured in righteous wrath, despising the world that cast him out. Small wonder, for I can tell you now, at the end of my little tale, Gordon Cumming was railroaded. He didn't cheat at baccarat. I learned this within 24 hours of the verdict, but there was nothing to be done, even if I wanted to. No one would have credited the truth for a moment. I didn't myself at first, for it beggared belief. But there can be no doubt about it, for it fits exactly with the evidence of both sides, and the source is unimpeachable. I've lived with her 70 years, after all, and know that while she may suppress a little very, and suggest a touch of falsy on occasion, Elspeth ain't a liar. We were at breakfast, which for me, in my indulgent age, was Russian style, sausage, brandy, and coffee, and for her the fodder of her native heath, porridge, ham, eggs, black pudding, some piscine abomination called Arbroath Smokies, oat cakes, rolls, and marmalade. God knows how she's kept her figure. While we read the morning journals, usually she'd read some prattles together, but that morning she was silent, absorbing the coming debacle. When she'd laid her eyeglasses aside, she sat for a while, stirring her tea in a thoughtful, contented manner. "Rum business, that," says I. "Do you know, old girl, it's beyond me. Granted, he's a poisonous tick. I still can't believe he cheated."
"Neither he did," says she.
"What's that? Oh, I see. You don't think it likely either. Well, I don't suppose we'll ever know for certain, but..."
"Oh, but I do know,"
says she, laying down her spoon.
"He did not cheat at all. Well, I think not on the first night, and I know he did not on the second."
She sipped her tea while I choked on my brandy. "What do you mean, you know? Don't know a thing about it. Why, when I asked you that night at Tramby, remember, whether he'd been jockeying his stakes, you didn't know what I meant, even."
"I knew perfectly well what you meant, but it would not have been prudent to say anything just then. It would not have suited,"
says she calmly,
"at all."
"You mean, you saying you knew then he hadn't cheated?" In my agitation, I overset my cup. Coffee all over the shop. "But how can you possibly? What the blazes are you talking about?"
"There's no need to fly at me or take that crabbed tone,"
says she, rising swiftly.
"Quick, put a plate under the cloth before it stains the table. Drat, such a mess. Here, let me tend to it. And you ring for Jane. Oh, the best walnut."
"Damn Jane and the walnut, will you tell me what you mean?" She had the cloth back, clucking and mopping the table with a napkin. "Elspeth, what's this rot about coming, not cheating? How do you know, damn it?"
"It's a mercy your cup had gone cold. Oh, how vexing. It'll have to be French polished."
She peered at the wood.
"Oh, dear, why did I not wait till you were settled? Good Kens, I should know by now what you like in the morning."
She discarded the napkin with dainty distaste and resumed her seat.
"Sir William Gordon Cumming did not cheat. That is what I mean."
She sighed in a patient Griselda sort of way.
"The fact is, you see, I did."
Lord knows what I looked like in that moment. A cod on the slab, likely. She lifted a swift, warning finger.
"Now, please, my love, do not raise your voice or rage at me. It's done, and there is no undoing it, and the servants would hear. If you're angry, I'm sorry, but if you just bide quiet and hear me out, you may not be too angry, I hope.
She smiled at me as though an infant drooling in my crib and took a sip of tea.
Now then, it was I who added counters to his stakes, just once or twice, and not nearly as often as they said. Why, I was quite shocked when I read in the papers last week the kind of evidence they were giving. Even Mrs. Wilson, dear me, if there'd been that much hanky-panky with the counters, the whole world must have seen, the prince and everyone. The way folk deceive themselves. But I suppose, she shrugged, that the general solicitor, or whatever they call him, was right, and they saw what they wanted to see. Only they didn't, if you know what I mean. For it wasn't Billy coming cheating, it was me. Or should it be I? Anyway, I only did it now and then. Well, three or four times, perhaps, I'm not sure, but often enough to make them think he was cheating. I'm glad to say, she added complacently, and you should not be angry, I think, because he deserved it, and I was right.
It's hard, when your life has contained as many hellish surprises as mine, to put them in order of disturbance. Ghoul Shah appearing in that Afghan dungeon, Cleone whipping off her eye patch, meeting Bismarck in his nightmare castle, waking to find myself trussed over a gun muzzle at Gwalior, and any number of equally beastly shocks. But I've never been more thoroughly winded than by those incredible words across the breakfast dishes on Wednesday, June the 10th, 1891. From Elspeth, of all people. For a moment I wondered if she was making a ghastly joke, or if that pea brain had given way at last. But no, I knew her artless prattle too well, and that she meant every damned word, and there was no point in bellowing disbelief.
This book is continued on Disc 10.